Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi. The OMI in Bookomi, as many listeners will know, stands for Original Memorable Insights from books by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode,
I'm George Dyson, author of Analogia, and this is my OMI for Bookomi.
We meet the science historian whose original insights on the evolution of humankind and technology are made even more memorable by the way he considers both in the context of the natural world.
We developed what we call stored program computers, the things we just take for granted now that a computer has a program and it does exactly what it is programmed to do. And that was due to your colleague Alan Turing, who had those insights. Suddenly it took over the world. But it's led us to this assumption that everything can be programmed and that, but that's not the way nature works.
George Dyson was born into science royalty. His father, Freeman Dyson, was a hugely influential theoretical physicist who, among many projects and concepts that take his name, helped to make space travel possible. While his mother, Verena Huber Dyson, was a brilliant mathematician in her own right, well known for her work on group theory and formal logic. In his latest book, Analogia, The Entangled Destinies of Nature, Human Beings and Machines, George challenges the assumption that digital technology made by human code is naturally superior and separate to analog design, and that the machines we imagine as our own may not be the machines that nature intends for tomorrow. George, welcome to Bookomi.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, you know, George, it's really hard to know where to start with such a big subject, but I'll have a go. The story weaving through our Analogia begins in 1716 at a German health spa with the polymath Gottfried Leibniz and the Russian Tsar Peter the Great. Why were they there and what were they discussing of such great significance for the future of science and reason and mankind?
Yes, that you hit right on the sort of center piece of the book, which I was trying to... This is my fifth book, and I've sort of had two very different interests in life. My main interest was in building kayaks, and particularly building the kayaks that were called baidarkas that were used by the Russians who came to Alaska in the 18th century. And that sort of took up most of my life. And then I became distracted by sort of the history of modern technology and history of computing. I had these two very different interests, and I wanted to put them together in some way, but I had no idea how. And then, of course, Leibniz was sort of he's the patron saint of digital computing. And in researching Leibniz, I discovered this meeting he had with Peter the Great. They spent 8 days, they gave up alcohol for 8 days, which was very difficult. So I think they replaced alcohol with lots of deep conversations. And Leibniz, it turned out, tried to convince Peter to launch two projects. One was to take over the world with digital computers. And the other was to launch an expedition to North America to try and figure out whether America and Asia were joined or separated. That's how we found Bering Strait. And so it was just an instant revelation to me to find that somehow Leibniz had combined these two sort of paths in my life, and the book sort of fell out of that.
And you mentioned boat building there. You're a very skilled boat builder, aren't you, in terms of kayaks? And I'll get to that in a minute. But in the early 70s, you lived almost, well, I'd call it a wilderness, but for 3 years in a treehouse in British Columbia. What drove you there? Did you just want to get away from everything, or were you there to get closer to the subject matter of your work?
Actually, I was not that. My treehouse was 6 miles from downtown Vancouver. So you could actually paddle a canoe into downtown Vancouver, go to a movie downtown and come back home.
I had a very different image of you. I had an image of you being some kind of Robinson Crusoe in the trees.
Yet it was in a very wild piece of land that's now still a park, and the house was 95 feet up. And for me, actually, if you tell people you lived in a tree in British Columbia for 3 years, the assumption is you're sort of making some kind of political statement. Nothing political at all. I just wasn't trying to save the rainforest or anything. It just was a very beautiful, convenient place to live. And I built it when I was 19, done a lot of climbing and working in high rigging on boats. So it seemed very natural to me.
You had an amazing childhood, didn't you? And in terms of the people and the company that you kept and you grew up in, I mean, you had an idyllic childhood really in terms of nature and your contact with it, but intellectually you were surrounded by the greats.
Yes, but as a child, you don't recognize that. Wherever you grow up, you think it's just normal. And then later you find out maybe it wasn't normal. So
Well, because I suppose people say that, don't they, when they're growing up with, if you're the child of a rock star, a musician, you were the child of rock star scientists, weren't
To a degree, that sort of came later. My father
you?
was not that well known, except among physicists as a child, but then he became better known. It was really, in a lot of ways, my mother who more brought me into the world I'm in. It was, she was sort of kept up mountaineering and loved the American West and the wilderness and took me out there.
And in that treehouse, you came very close, and you took that time to read and research. And a lot of, I mean, obviously, it's quite a while ago, nearly 40 years ago, but it's informed your work and that your previous books and this book, Analogia, in particular. If I could talk about the book for a second, well, let's talk about it for more than a second. Let's talk about it for the rest of the pod. In the book, it feels like humankind, or your view of humankind, or to qualify that, industrial humankind, has always had a need to control, to measure and quantify, to communicate at faster and faster speed that gives it, us, them, a sense of superiority over the natural or the primitive world. Are we superior?
Well, of course, I think no, and in many ways, I'm trying to make an argument for that. I think we took a hugely, not wrong, but we've gone sideways. And this is, of course, one of the reasons I can say this is because my last book, Turing's Cathedral, was all the other way. That was a deep history of how we developed what we call stored program computers, the things we just take for granted now that a computer has a program and it does exactly what it is programmed to do. And that was due to your colleague Alan Turing, who had those insights. Suddenly it took over the world. But it's led us to this assumption that everything can be programmed and that but that's not the way nature works. Nature uses effectively digital programming for genetics, for passing the instructions, for error correction from one generation to the next, or for introducing errors, which is how evolution works. But in nature, nature uses analog computing for real-time intelligence and control. You take apart a brain, you're not going to find any digital program. And I think we need to get back to that. The sort of the digital revolution, all revolutions, they tend to go too far.
Yeah, the epochs you describe, and it's quite sweet, although you have a really clear narrative through the 300 years of the book from Leibniz to the present day, you describe four epochs in the history and destiny of humans, technology, and nature. Would you mind just describing what they are and where are we today?
Yes, I mean, if I can remember them, I think the first is sort of the pre-technological epoch where we were limited to things that we can build with our own hands. We sort of made our own tools, and then I'm probably getting this wrong. Then there was this epoch where machines started to build other machines. We built machine tools with which you could build other machines, and then we had the epoch that we're just coming out of, where we control the machines through programming, and now I believe we're entering a fourth epoch, which is sort of in a way takes the machines back to nature, where we have machines that are evolving beyond programmable control, which is the difference between analog and digital computing. Analog computer, there is no programmed control, which is why it works so well.
In that sense, it's what was really fascinating and instructive in the book, and really opened my eyes and mind to the difference between, or us, the way we categorize digital and analog programming. The thought of nature being a programmer, through DNA and through coding into the future to set norms and to set patterns, but then actually, as it's happening, nature and life is also analog. And those two different things, I always thought of just digital and programming being machine-led rather than in nature. And that's those where those worlds collide and cross over, and our misinterpretation of it, and then our attempt to control it, I think, are the tension in the book. Am I right there?
Yes, you need both. It's not an either or situation. And just to explain the difference, it's not a question of what the computer. You can build a digital computer out of wood or marbles, like Leibniz wanted to do, running down tracks, and likewise, you can build analog computers out of silicon. So it's a question of whether you are computing with discrete logical functions or computing sort of statistically with just relative frequencies of things and so on. So if you look at, so there's two ways of doing this from the bottom up, where we actually are starting to build silicon chips that compute in analog ways, or for the top down, which is, I think, sort of more interesting, is sort of analog computing in the wild, where digital computers are being assembled into analog networks that do analog computation, which is how we got where we are, that after World War II, there was all this analog electronic equipment lying around, vacuum tubes, and, cathode ray tubes, radar screens, and so on. And then a few oddball groups in Cambridge and Manchester and in the United States started putting that analog equipment together to make digital computers. And now, of course, they had a very hard time explaining to people what they were trying to do. Now we take it for granted, and the same thing is happening. People are taking all this digital equipment, which is, it's like war surplus, it's effectively free, and assembling it into these large analog computers. If you look at the four companies that were hauled before the U.S. Congress, you know, last week, Facebook, Google, Apple, and Amazon, effectively all four of those companies are large analog computers. What's most interesting about what they're doing is really the analog computation, not the digital computation that it's built on.
So yeah, because you describe analog computation as architecture, is that right? It's the architecture which makes it different to digital binary computation.
Yes, I mean, what's powerful is the complexity, and in a digital computer, which was, of course, Turing's great genius, the computer itself can be extremely simple. And it's the code, it's the software that's extremely complex. And analog computers, it's sort of the other way around. There isn't software. The complexity is in the topology of the network and the, you know, sort of the frequency at which things connect where.
Yeah, like human networks as well. So social media is complex because of the social networks it employs.
Exactly. And I mean, for instance, the financial system has been a long, long developing analog computer that works by sort of the pulse frequency of currency exchange and so on. So it's nothing new. It's just become very fast and very large scale.
And you're referring to the vacuum tubes of the 40s and the 50s and computer technology being, or the vacuums being replaced by transistors and increasingly fast transistors. You say in the book, life forms, technologies, and institutions often enter a period of extravagance before going extinct. Which institutions or technologies might be on the verge of extinction, do you think, right now?
Yeah, it's always hard to see when you're, you know, when you're in the middle of it. Of course, I grew up at the end of the vacuum tube era, so I have a fondness for that, sort of a warmth for it. Now we're sort of living in this enormous extravagance of digital computing. There's sort of so much we don't know what to do with it. We're giving it away for free. That's clearly going to change into something else. The question is what it's going to change into.
In terms of change, even over 300 years or 15,000 years, which you go back into the history of the Indian people in America and the Apaches in particular, brains haven't changed. The makeup of the brain hasn't changed for tens of thousands of years. And I asked neuroscientist David Eagleman about the brain because I'm fascinated by this notion of processing power increasing. And I asked him that if processing power increases exponentially, wouldn't the ultimate outcome for AI be something like a brain? And I know this has been talked about since Ada Lovelace and before, but
yes.
But he believes, and it's something that you deal with in the book, he believes that it's impossible because digital code can't replicate the random accumulation or understand the meaning and the metaphor of experience and action. Machines can only process a chain of ones and zeros faster, but can't reason or judge between, you know, two similar things. It has to be one thing or the other with digital coding. What do you think? What's your personal view of that? Where is AI heading in terms of the human brain?
Oh, I completely agree with David Eagleman. I mean, we're fellow sort of, because he's a biologist and he works with real brains, so he understands that. It's the people who come from some of the people on the computing side, I think, don't. I mean, we may well build real AI, but I don't think it's going to be digital. I think it's going to be analog for all those same reasons. There's sort of this problem, this sort of fatal flaw that if you have to do it all with software, the software becomes just impossibly complex. And we can't even do in software what the brain of a, you know, of an insect does. So I don't think we're going to, I think it's not a case of we need more power to get there. I think we're just never going to get there that way.
It is a common misconception though, isn't it? Because I mean, do you think we've become obsessed with software and algorithms and AI in that direction and programmatic advertising? And I mean, you know, that we've almost been distracted by that whilst the big frameworks, the big architectural analog systems have taken control of everything, really.
Yes, that's the main sort of message at the end of this whole story I'm trying to tell, is that we're sort of asleep at the switch, literally. And partly driven by the fact that people were very afraid of computers at the beginning. I mean, when Turing was von Neumann, these people were pushing these ideas, was a lot of pushback saying, oh, you know, this is dangerous. You're going to create machines that control us. And so the answer always was, no, don't worry about it, because the machines can't work without being programmed, and people are writing the program. So there's nothing to worry about. The machines are technically under control. You know, I think nature is much smarter than that. And there's no reason that nature can't sort of go around our back and say, well, if you think you're going to control everything, here comes some machines that are not programmed and are not under control.
And we don't know
what they'll look like. But the your view of nature in the book as well, I mean, let's talk about your passion for boat building and your skill there. Alut, am I pronouncing that correctly? Alut kayaks? Is Alut the right?
Yes, Alut.
Alut kayaks. Why were you attracted to them in particular? And how do they play a role in the narrative of an analogia?
Just sort of things, children just have these obsessions. I was obsessed with boats. I went through my father's letters doing some other research, and I found a letter where I must have been 4 or 5 years old, and he took me out in a rowboat for the first time. And I, at dinner, we always had a conversation, and I said, well, I finally figured out, you know, I said, oh, I finally figured out how the boat moves. You pull on the oars and it makes a hole in the water, and the boat falls forward into it. And I thought that was just great. My father thought it was good. But my sister, the people think it was hard being the son of the great Freeman Dyson. It was much harder being Esther's little brother. So her answer was, well, that's not so great. I can make the boat move without understanding it.
Now, Esther is, as I should say, is a world famous tech analyst and investor as well.
Yes, very.
All right. So, yeah.
I think this is sort of nature's, you know, one of nature's methods is to, if you're going to have children, they are diametrically different. That sort of protects the gene pool, that kids go off in different directions. So I was just obsessed with boats. And then at age 12, I bought plans from Percy Blanford in the UK, who after World War II started getting kids. He was a scout leader building these canoes that you could build, you know, for just a few pounds in cheap material. So I built a kayak and just, it sort of took over my life. And then, of course, I realized that the Native Americans had been kayaking for probably 10,000 years. And that was, trying to find documentation of that, it turned out that was best documented by the Russians, by the people that Peter the Great sent, who kept very accurate drawings and plans and journals of what they saw. So that's how I became a historian, just trying to dig out these Russian journals.
And the interesting thing, which you raise, and the point that you raise in the book, is that the Alouettes regarded their kayaks as fellow living beings.
Yes, in very definite, tangible ways, some of which are, you know, not even proper for your listening audience, or at least a broadcast audience. But no, so the kayak was very much a fellow living being. People spent their whole lives with the Aleuts, were buried in burial caves. There was a cave recently, one of the last discovered before there was a moratorium on any excavation. So a 2-year-old child is buried with a toy kayak. So it was like the first toy you had as a child. And then when you finally died, you were buried with your adult kayak.
And it's that proximity to nature, isn't it? That fusion with nature. You also mentioned, you talk about language and how if aliens visited the Earth at any stage, they might see dolphins and whales communicating in a way that is much more straightforward than humans communicate, which is in noise. And therefore we create complex languages and code to communicate, which actually might not be the right way or the most efficient way of communicating.
Right. It's I think another huge misconception that intelligence means language. That you, or communication has to be language. There's all sorts of ways of communicating without language. I sort of had a personal interest in this because that 50 years ago, I ended up, you know, being among killer whales when they were first being, when all these researchers showed up thinking that if they recorded the underwater communications, they would find the language. And for 50 years, there's been more and more and more recordings, more and more computing power, and nobody has found the language because there may not be a language there, which doesn't mean they're not intelligent and not communicating.
It's like we kind of make up the rules as we go along to satisfy our sense of superiority, which is what we started talking about. How do you feel then as a historian of science, past, present and the future, knowing what you know, do you believe in intelligent design or are we just designing ourselves and what have we left to learn?
Well, this is a dangerous thing to say because I do believe in intelligent design and that right then the conversation normally ends. Oh my God, he believes in intelligent design. But that's what my second book, Darwin Among the Machines, is good part about that. And that goes to Samuel Butler, who wrote the original Darwin Among the Machines in 1863. And Butler was sort of Darwin's most difficult critic. And Butler strongly makes that argument that evolution is an intelligent process, but it's a bottom-up intelligence. It's not top-down in the sense that, you know, that some deity decrees that this is how design is going to happen, but it has intelligence. It's an intelligent process. And we, you know, now we realize that the entire genetic network in biology, it's performing a form of computation, and there is some intelligence there. So to just say there is no intelligence in design, I think is wrong. But it's not top-down.
And writing, you mentioned Samuel Butler there, because I mean, you've introduced me to Samuel Butler, thank you, because I wasn't aware of his work and his dialogues and his writings and the fierce arguments, and actually the welcome arguments from Darwin's point of view. They weren't really enemies, were they? They were great going on. You know, it was a complex argument that was going on at the time in the 1800s. And around the Industrial Revolution as well, machines and the notion of machines were very problematic for thinkers and authors like Butler. And he wrote, and you quote him in the book, "It appears we ourselves are creating our successors and the machines are gaining ground upon us." I mean, that was, what, 150, nearly 200 years ago.
Yes, and he wrote that in a hand-built, you know, sheep herder's cabin that he built in the wilderness of New Zealand. He had gone as far, he was causing trouble for his family. So he went as far away from London as he could get and then still had these deep insights into Darwin's work. It's kind of like, so of course I have this resonance with Butler because his 3 years he spent three years in that hut. It was like my 3 years in the treehouse where likewise I had all this time to read.
I was going to say that. I mean, obviously you've got the same titles for your books. I'd say through all the characters that you talk about in the book that there's definitely a warmth and a similarity to, there's obviously a relatability for you for Samuel Butler.
Yes. And one of the great things, sort of putting this book together that has these illustrations, that there is it was known to me, there is a photograph of Butler's hut taken in just after he left in 1866. But I could never find it. It's always produced as a lithograph that claims to be after a photo. But anyway, in searching, I finally found a London dealer who had the original album by Edward Seeley, who took that photograph. So, and he kindly, you know, scanned at very high resolution, the original. So in this book, finally, is a really good, crisp photograph of Butler's hut. It's quite remarkable. You sort of think that the way artists sort of improve the background and make it look more in the wilderness than it really is, but it really is. I mean, that was hugely fun to find that.
And do you think what can we learn from him today? I mean, the words, you've almost brought his philosophy and his thinking into the modern day and you've updated it with Analogia. Could you say that it's an homage to him, the book? Would it be dedicated to him?
Oh, yes, very much so. I mean, and what's new, again, which I sort of missed at the time I wrote Darwin Among the Machines, which was, you know, 25 years ago, was that one of Butler's essays, there was actually notes for a book he never finished writing, but he he makes the statement that real AI, real artificial intelligence, would be driven by advertising. And he sort of runs down the way it's going to go, that it's actually going to be driven by advertising. That's going to be the sort of killer app. And that's the world we live in today, which 20 years ago, you know, when the internet was sort of becoming popular, nobody foresaw that it would become, you know, it would be driven by advertising. Of course, Butler saw that very clearly at the beginning.
Amazing. Well, George, thanks for sharing your OMI with Bokomi today.
Thank you. Very great to sort of have this remote conversation in these strange times.
George's book, Analogia, The Entangled Destinies of Nature, Human Beings and Machines, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. And if you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up to our most wanted email at bokomi.com. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bokomi pod, please let us know by following or subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Stay safe, intelligent, and remember, life is for living and learning. Bye for now. Thank you.